Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So yesterday, the Senate passed the $95 billion foreign aid package, the majority of which is going to Ukraine, with some for Israel and a little left over for Taiwan and the Indo-Pacific. The speechifying was interesting. Speechifying in the Senate, I'm talking about. First, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell on the floor.
Today, the Senate sits for a test on behalf of the entire nation. It's a test of American resolve, our readiness, and our willingness to lead. And the stakes of failure are abundantly clear. Failure to help Ukraine stand against Russian aggression now means inviting escalation against our closest treaty allies and trading partners. It means greater risk that American forces would become involved in conflict. It means more costly deployments of our military and steeper military requirements to defend against aggression.
So argument you've undoubtedly heard before, that better to spend a dollar today than $2 with ground troops tomorrow, essentially. You always have to raise the specter of ground troops as if we don't provide the money that Ukraine, that Zelensky is asking for, more like demanding, then it necessarily increases the prospect that we'll have to deploy American soldiers to Eastern Europe. I don't know that the two follow. I guess if you believe the domino theory, then you could argue, and maybe Jed Babin will when we talk to him about this a little bit later in the program, that, well, we have this NATO alliance, and Ukraine is not a NATO country, but there are NATO countries in Putin's crosshairs. And if we're going to abide the compact that an attack on one is an attack on all, then we would have to respond in kind. I guess that's the argument. But it is interesting that the specter of ground troops is always sort of a threat that's made when D.C. politicians want to throw money at problems. The ounce of prevention argument, I don't know if you find that compelling. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line.
Like even Brett Hume was on Fox News yesterday saying, well, you know, we don't have troops on the ground, so we're not going to have any casualties ever if we give them this money.
Well, yeah.
Right.
If the in the absence of troops,
right.
No one will die in Ukraine. I agree,
exactly.
But
I don't know.
How does that logically follow that if we don't give them money, we have to send troops? It doesn't logically follow.
No, but they dangle that in front of us like it's some possibility, and I don't think.
Yeah, well, I understand. That's the you know, essentially the veiled threat that they're making. We don't want to see troops over there. By the way, it's such an odd sort of bluff, in my opinion, because where the issue is maybe a 50-50 matter in terms of support for Ukraine among the American electorate, sending ground troops sending American soldiers, putting American soldiers in harm's way. That's not much of a threat when there is overwhelming opposition to doing so. And really no appetite in an election year, especially for the political class in D.C. to do so. So I don't know how much of a threat that is, really, in terms of this sense of urgency that the political class is trying to create. By the way, 19 Republican senators voted against it. Only 19, this package that, again, as Byron Donalds said the other day, you know, they want to make this about, he's essentially saying, they want to make this all about Ukraine, but it's not all about Ukraine. It's the promises that were made by House Republican leadership that are not being kept.
He was
Byron Donalds on Squawk Box.
My response to you, Joe, is in Washington, things are never linked. What happens in Washington all the time is that deals are cut based upon leverage and the ability to count votes. So you use every legislative tool at your disposal to accomplish your means. There have been many bills that have gone through Capitol Hill where there are two diametrically opposed subjects, but they were put together in order to get the votes for it to become law. We all know this. So to ignore the reality of security for our nation while you're providing for security for other nations, as far as I'm concerned, does not make sense at all. So the fact that you're talking about security, whether it's here at home or abroad, those are linking subjects. But look, at the end of the day, this is the package that the speaker and the leadership put on the floor. That's why you had a majority of Republicans, 112 of us, vote against funding to Ukraine, because we had been told by our leadership, and frankly, we had been telling the American people that there was not going to be more Ukraine aid unless our border was secured. That ended up not being the case.
That ended up not being the case indeed. Bob, Buffalo Grove, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Thanks for taking my call. Maybe you can educate me on this one senator and play the soundbite, but I learned something this weekend. One senator said that we got to give money to the Ukraine because we got to protect our border, because the Ukraine border is our border.
Yeah,
Yeah,
Gerald Connolly was a House member, so he's a socialist from Virginia, said that. That's right. Thanks for the call, Bob. Right, Ukraine border is our border.
What about our own border? Right.
But the point that Byron Donalds makes is really the salient one. And so there's a response to that from Republicans. Mitch McConnell has the response. Most won't say it quite the way that he is saying it, but this is essentially the Republican position, especially in the Senate, to the argument that Byron Donalds make, is that there was this promise, and now we had House Republican leadership do an about face and say we don't need to extract any sort of policy changes at the border in order to contemplate this foreign aid package, because there's some sense of urgency with the prospective spring offensive by Putin. Here's the real position in response to the criticism that you heard from Donalds. Mitch McConnell again, of course.
I think the demonization of Ukraine began by Tucker Carlson, who, in my opinion, ended up where he should have been all along, which is interviewing Vladimir Putin. And so he had an enormous audience, which convinced a lot of rank-and-file Republicans that maybe this was a mistake. I think the former president had sort of mixed views on it. We all felt that border was a complete disaster, myself included. And Chad, you remember covering the phases we went through. First, there was an effort to make law, which requires you to deal with Democrats. And then a number of our members thought it wasn't good enough. And then our nominee for president didn't seem to want us to do anything at all. That took months to work our way through it. So we ended up doing the supplemental that was originally proposed, which dealt with not all problems. It didn't solve the border problem, but certainly addressed the growing threats at the moment.
So Senator Freeze frame there, Mitch McConnell saying essentially the only reason that this is contentious, this foreign aid funding, is because of Tucker Carlson. And the only reason we don't have a deal on the border included in this foreign aid funding is because of Trump. But for Tucker Carlson and Trump, all things would be running smoothly in a wonderfully bipartisan fashion, which, you know, nothing bad ever happens when Republicans and Democrats get together, as we all know. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. Michael, Southside.
Morning, Dan. Morning, Amy. Thank you both for taking my call. The whole issue of funding for Ukraine makes me want to gag. I can remember 12 years ago, the American left skewered Mitt Romney when he said that Russia was a problem. And now here we are funding a war against Russia. Like I said, this situation just makes me sick. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Michael. Well, something else, I mean, just in terms of what McConnell said about, and this reporting that's been going on. Oh, Trump didn't want anything because he's playing politics with the border. They're always trying to flip the script to, you know, misdirect attention away from the power they're choosing not to exercise that they have. And I'm talking about the Biden administration. And that's really the key here. To the extent that Trump was saying, don't do the deal that Langford and McConnell cooked up with Schumer in the Senate, that we discussed in great detail, of course, and that had no audience in the House, either House GOP leadership. Speaker Johnson, you'll recall, rejected it as well. But the suggestion that Trump don't do anything because, you know, we want this to be an issue. No, it was don't sell out for funding. And this is the position of Tom Homan and other people as well who are actually knowledgeable about border security and committed to it. We don't need more agents. That's not fundamental. We need policy changes. And so the point was, you have to extract policy changes. You have to force Joe Biden to make policy changes in exchange for any deal on foreign aid funding with their monomaniacal focus on Ukraine when we say foreign aid funding, which it was. So that was the point. Get Biden to move, which is an acknowledgement that this is his responsibility, that he has the power to improve the situation, and that he's choosing not to do it. Maintain the focus there, because that's where you can actually affect the most change the most quickly because of the virtual plenary power the president has when it comes to border security. So McConnell is misrepresenting this whole, oh, Trump killed it because he wants to make this a political issue come the fall, where we're the solutionists in the Senate. Hardly. Hardly. All right.
This is the Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today, 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So, day two of Trump's trial in Manhattan concluded yesterday. And just to set a baseline here, to remember, you know, the foundation, the foundational issue, so we don't get all caught up in the day-to-day, did or did not violate this ridiculous, and I would argue unconstitutional, gag order he's under. Just the baseline here, which is, this is, the whole thing is absurd. The whole thing is absurd. Jonathan Turley, George Washington law professor.
What is clear is, in this case, Trump is right. I mean, this is an embarrassment. I mean, the fact that we are actually talking about this case being presented in a New York courtroom leaves me in utter disbelief. I mean, the arguments today did, in fact, capture all the problems here. You know, you had this misdemeanor under state law where that had run out. This is going back to related to the 2016 election. And they zapped it back into life by alleging that there was a campaign finance violation under the federal laws that doesn't exist. The Department of Justice doesn't view it this way. But on top of that, you've got these tough factual issues that were laid out well by the Trump team, saying someone else designated this as a legal expense, and he was actually paid far in excess of this because of this was a legal account. But also keep in mind, this is what Hillary Clinton's people did. You know, remember when they funded the Steele dossier, which they denied to reporters, they put it as a legal expense, and then they fought the eventual fine that they received from the federal government, saying, but it was a legal expense. But now you've got some of the same Democrats supporting this bizarre theory.
So, I mean, that's just to establish that I'm really not that interested in what happens on a day-to-day basis other than Trump's pronouncements when he comes, when he emerges from the courtroom, because the whole thing is illegitimate.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. And don't forget, this all started because of Stormy Daniels. Went to the National Enquirer, said, I have a story, and if you pay me, I'll be quiet. And she, her attorney, is in jail for fraud. She she owes President Trump $600,000 for frivolous lawsuits. Remember that? People forget about that. And again, she was represented by a guy who's already in prison for extortion, Michael Avenatti.
Right. Former darling of CNN and MSNBC and prospective presidential candidate. Right. But that's not what this didn't all start with Stormy Daniels, in the sense that whatever did or did not happen between Stormy Daniels and Trump has nothing to do with the rule of law.
Right.
That may have something to do with character. But it doesn't have anything to do with criminal law. And that's the issue. And that's the point that Turley is making. This becomes just a political matter. Trump obviously making the point that he has been making for months that this is election interference. He did so again yesterday.
So we're locked up in a courtroom, but this guy's out there campaigning. If you call it a campaign, every time he opens his mouth, he gets himself into trouble.
Exactly. So he should be happy that Biden is on the campaign trail.
Well, but I mean, he has no freedom of speech. He has no freedom of movement. He's stuck there. I don't know if you've ever been to a trial. I haven't been on trial, but I've had to cover one. And it is you can't move. You can't leave. If he leaves, if he talks during the trial, he'll be held in contempt of court. If he leaves to go to maybe his son's graduation, he'll be arrested. It's sick. And then when he speaks to the media, he has to be, there's no microphones up close. That's why it's echoey. He's behind this cage. I mean, they're just treating him horribly, and they're doing this for election interference so that he cannot be out on the campaign trail.
Yeah, it's the Hannibal Lecter treatment. His supporters can't come within a country mile of the courthouse either because, of course, they're all insurrectionists and threats to the public and threats to our democracy and so on and so forth. But in point of fact, I think Trump is doing a pretty good job of campaigning while complaining that he can't campaign. I'm not saying that the gag order is appropriate. It's not. The whole thing I just said is illegitimate. But and he should be making that part of the argument in addition to a couple other parts when he has the opportunity. I mean, he had the before he had court yesterday, he did a gaggle, press gaggle with the former prime minister of Japan. So he's got a world leader on his arm in one moment, and then he goes back to his criminal trial the next moment. There are things he can do around New York City. I mean, Whatever he does is going to be newsworthy. So when he went to the bodegas and had those interactions with bodega owners and recalling the bodega owner who was wrongly accused of murder, speaking of criminal injustice, for defending himself from an attacker in his bodega, Alba, remember? So there's other things he can do. And I think our friend Hugh Hewitt made this point, and I like it. I thought this was a good idea. I mean, Columbia University is not far away.
Oh, that would
do a little walkthrough.
Yeah, the encampment's still up, so he could do that.
Yeah, do a little walkthrough over at Columbia and talk to some of the Jewish students there.
Well, Trump did two very smart things yesterday before he went into the courtroom. He talked about the Pennsylvania primary and talked about David McCormick. Right. And then he talked about anti-Semitism on college campuses. And has Biden talked about that at all? And he's a free man. He's got a microphone wherever he wants it. No. But Trump did from the courtroom or outside the courtroom yesterday. I thought that was smart.
Well, Biden tried to talk about it when he was being squired around by AOC, but he had what people were calling his fine people on both sides. I don't like that characterization because the fine people on both sides is a misnomer.
Here that is. It was during Earth Day celebrations, Dan.
President, what's your message to the protesters? Do you condemn the anti-Semitic protests on college campuses?
I condemn the anti-Semitic protests. That's why I've set up a program to deal with that. I also condemn those who don't understand what's going on with the Palestinians.
Yeah. There's condemnation on both sides because I got a middle of the issue. I'm worried about what's going on in Dearborn, Michigan. I set up a program to deal with it. What's the program?
Right, that's what I said too, Dan.
Explain it to us.
Yeah,
yeah.
What's the name of it? Where is it based out of? What?
Well, so that was his best effort. Biden's to address the issue again. Like I said, he's got to middle it, and so that's what he did. And Trump, just one other piece from Trump in day two, per the restrictions he's under and why we're trying to divine things, and you just see people repeating the same sort of exchanges and lines from the trial, having to trust the D.C. press corps, the Eastern Seaboard big government press corps, to give us the nuances and the blow-by-blow in the trial is not a great position to be in if you're trying to make gather an informed understanding.
And I don't even know if you're allowed to put them in. We have a gag order, which to me is totally unconstitutional. I'm not allowed to talk, but people are allowed to talk about me. So they can talk about me, they can say whatever they want, they can lie, but I'm not allowed to say anything. I just have to sit back and look at why a conflicted judge has ordered me to have a gag order. I don't think anybody's ever seen anything like this. I'd love to talk to you people. I'd love to say everything that's on my mind, but I'm restricted because I have a gag order. And
the best thing is he holds up a stack of newspapers and just reads the headlines. Like even the New York Times, the gray lady, and they'll read the headline about how his trial is unjust.
In effect, he is campaigning to multiple audiences, to the jury as well as to the electorate. Are there other things that he could be doing? I mean, as I said, I like the Hugh Hewitt idea, and we'll get to Trump also in addition to continue to campaign. He has cut a message on the issue of what's going on at college campuses that we'll get to at the top of the next hour when we talk more about the ongoing pit protesters, the pro-Islamist terrorism protesters. But other things he could be doing, cutting videos, meeting with world leaders, doing a little bit of door knocking in neighborhoods around Manhattan, in and around Manhattan. I mean, he's doing a lot. I'm not saying that there is anything that's obvious, but he's also being outspent in the swing states significantly by Biden, but he's still managing to hold modest leads in those states. Long way to go. Long way to go.
He's got to
stay creative. Stay creative. I think that there is, the more of this drags on and the more embarrassing it becomes and the more fact-free, evidence-free, the assertions made by Alvin Bragg, the more obvious it becomes that is the case, then the bigger the boomerang will be to Trump's benefit with respect to this whole circus.
And people forget Matthew Colangelo. I mean, he was Biden's former acting associate attorney general. And he left a cushy job at the Department of Justice to take this case, to move to New York, crime-ridden New York, and do this case. This is so politically motivated.
Right. Politically motivated and with the Biden administration's fingerprints on it, too, as he pretends that, you know, these are just local jurisdictions and I don't have anything to do with it. You know, though, these phony walls of separation that we're supposed to believe. If to the extent that people are paying attention, they're getting, you know, information at that granular level, is the extent that blows up in the Biden administration's face, that, you know, the politics that look so good in persecuting Trump ends up hoisting Biden Incorporated by their own petar. We'll see. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today. 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
Dan and Amy, good morning. And the performative art by cultural Marxists is not limited to the promotion of anti-Semitism. Wanted to update you on a story we brought you earlier in the week. The Tennessee House passed that bill that will allow teachers and staff in K-12 schools to carry a gun to protect the students.
Yeah, if they want to. It's not mandatory.
Of course. Staff who want to carry must go through 40 hours of gun training and have a psych evaluation.
Good.
And in response to that, of course, there was a die-in protest at the state capitol led by Justin Jones. You may remember Justin Jones. He was one of the legislators that was expelled for disrupting the proceedings in the House. Then he was reelected. Of course he was. But the whole imbroglio that he was involved in that ultimately led to his expulsion was after the Covenant School shooting. He and his Marxist colleagues wanted to do a symbolic gun ban, couldn't get any traction, and so he, you know, made a spectacle of himself. And he's still doing it in the face of this you know, what I would think would be relatively innocuous legislation. Somebody with training, psych evaluation, it's going to be done in consultation with the leadership of a particular school or school district. So that would, again, offer public and parental input on top of that. So you're going to have to build consensus in order to do this. And yet here we have everybody lying on the ground and pretending that they're dead because somehow the right to protect yourself and having people who are properly trained and prepared, desiring to provide this protection, to do so in the school is somehow going to lead to more death. And not just in the wake of the Covenant school shooting, but the other story we brought you this earlier in the week, which is that Montgomery County, Maryland, where thankfully law enforcement was able to intercede and arrest a teenager who had a 130-page manifesto and had plotted out at least two school shootings, at least in his mind, or was it her mind? And it was another trans identifying person. But anyway,
mainstream media didn't talk about it because this person's trans.
Well, right, but the larger point is, you know, that this continues to be an issue, and this is one substantive step to harden the target, if you will, something that we used to talk about, but the left only wants to focus on their Broadway performances in the political theater these days. So anyway, just wanted to, that is moving in Tennessee. And Governor Bill Lee is expected to sign it into law.
This is the Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. More mayhem on college campuses yesterday by Pitt protesters, pro-Islamist terrorist protesters, kids, and with a little help from some professional organizations and underwriting, no question. All you have to do is look at the tents and that encampment at Columbia and other schools where there are lines of tents that are the same. So somebody mass purchased those tents.
Right. And they're about $200. And then the larger ones run about $600 to $800.
Well, up at University of Minnesota, yeah. Mom is not going to let daughter have all the glory.
Oh, okay. Mom, are you embarrassing me in front of my friends?
No, no. It's okay. A tandem. It's a 1-2 all punch. Right. Talking about brotherly love spice, Ilhan Omar, her daughter attended past tense, Barnard College at about $100,000 to throw year there. And then she got suspended for her obstreperous conduct at Columbia with the other pro-Islamist terrorist protesters. And, you know, she got a star turn on MSNBC where she talked about it. Well, you're not going to crowd mom out of the spotlight. She wants her due as well. And she got it. I think she is the first member of Congress to speak at one of these pro-Islamist terrorist rallies. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yeah. AOC spoke about it, but she was at an Earth Day event.
Yeah, it doesn't count. No, it doesn't count.
But Omar was there on the ground with the protesters.
Well, right. And we're used to this in Chicago because we have city council members that have been speaking at these rallies. Mm. Of course. So it's no big deal for us, but for the rest of the nation, it's worth noting. So here's what Brotherly Love Spice had to say at the University of Minnesota with the celebrating the courage and the activism of these pro-Islamist terrorist protesters.
I have the proud honor of representing this incredible university in Congress. And I have to tell you, I am incredibly moved by your courage and bravery as a student body in putting your bodies on the line to stand in solidarity to end the genocide that is taking place in Gaza at this moment. I have have to tell you, it's been incredibly painful for the last 5 days to see the discovery, while there is a discovery of a mass grave of more than 200 Palestinians in Khan Yunis, that our media, our elected politicians, our president, every single leader is spending their time and energy in talking about the protests as if you all are not here to give voice to the genocide that is taking place in Gaza. What started out 5 days ago with only 70 students organizing themselves at Columbia University has now led to a nationwide university movement.
Yeah, it's a real real feather in the cap of higher ed, isn't it? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Just in case you think I'm being too harsh, they're not pro-Islamist terrorist protesters, Dan. Oh. These are not pro-Hamas people. So the line, the assertion that Omar made about this mass grave that was found, that's not true. That's Hamas propaganda.
Right.
That they she's repeating.
Built that grave themselves.
But it's not true. The evidence suggests that these are bodies that were buried by Palestinians amid the fighting in Gaza between the Israelis and these terrorist organizations and their, allies, essentially. But again, blood libel is nothing new for Ilhan Omar. So you can throw around the term genocide just like the kids do. She wants to get into the action. She's, you know, she's still cool. She's still down with the struggle and all that. This was the response to it. Just in case, again, you think I'm being hyperbolic here. This is what one of the screeching Colombians, students at Columbia, said to Jewish students who were sort of counter demonstrating. One Jewish student who had an Israeli flag wrapped around him was wearing a yarmulke. This is the exchange between those two individuals in New York. Again, just in case you think this is, well, come on, they're just kids. They're harmless kids. They're kids being silly. That's all. Uh-huh.
Silly summer's coming up.
Yeah. Right. Sure. Where do we have? Do we have that clip?
What's it labeled? Maybe I can help you.
Columbia students, we are Hamas. Where's that? Okay, we'll have to effort that. In addition to that... first, it was Alec Baldwin in a coffee shop. Now it's Eric Adams on a plane. So just if you're not on a college camp, just because you're not on a college campus doesn't mean they won't find you, call you out. Eric Adams, middle seat, by the way, sitting in the middle seat.
In exit row, I noticed that. Not in first class. He's down with the struggle, Dan.
Yeah.
He's and with the people in that 1 hour and 10 minute flight from Miami to New York.
And a beautiful flower passed by and recognized Eric Adams and had this to say.
Are you Eric Adams? Yeah, you! You support the genocide in Palestine. There are homeless people all over New York. You're always partying. You don't actually care about the citizens of New York. Why are you even in Miami? You know there are people being arrested there. People are homeless in New York. People cannot afford food. You keep cutting the education budget so that you can fund the police. That's all you care about, funding the police. Everything is underfunded because of you.
Trying to get the
okay. First of all, honey, the talking point was wrong. Everything's underfunded because they're giving money to the migrants.
Yeah, that's true.
Honey, not, yeah.
Yeah, that
not
is true.
Police. Get your, that, get that your would... back straight, girlfriend.
That probably would have assuaged her FU a little bit, maybe taking the edge off that a bit. Yeah, I mean, why was he in Miami? Is he in spring break? Is he taking it late this year? I gotta tell you, I mean, you know, again, I know this is how obnoxious they are. You feel bad for Alec Baldwin in a coffee shop. You feel bad for Eric Adams on a plane, but I don't really.
I don't feel bad for him.
Because the people like Eric Adams and Alec Baldwin have given birth to people like those who are accosting them. Never forget that. As I was saying before, this is the exchange at Columbia I was mentioning. Take a listen.
Keep it moving, you silent bitch. Keep it moving, you silent bitch.
I'm still okay. I'm still okay.
We are Hamas.
We are Hamas.
Wow. That's a good one. You're what? You're Hamas?
Yes, we're all Hamas, bitch.
I'm with Hamas. Fuck you.
She seems well-adjusted, balanced. We are Hamas, you Zionist pig. Those are your Ivy League kids. I mean, now the Jewish students are Ivy League as well, and you heard how well-mannered. Wait, I'm sorry, you're Hamas? Okay, I just want to make sure the record is correct.
You know, you are? I mean, people forget that a woman was being raped while they put her newborn baby in an oven? Like, just maybe give them one of those stories. I don't know. They terrorized so many people, caught them like in the morning, and then the people that were at the concert. I mean, what they did to people was barbaric and evil, and people forget about that.
We are Hamas. Yeah.
Really.
That's quite a statement. So where does this come from? The great protectors of the marginalized from a crossword. The censorious left, except when it comes to Jews. In this case, I mean, you could say the same for Christians in another context, pro-lifers in another context. But let's just talk about the double standard as it is evidenced by the treatment of Jewish students on campus and the sort of rhetoric that's used in the direction of Jewish people and obviously Israelis as well. Jewish people in America, obviously, as well as Israelis and the state of Israel. So where does this come from? Well, here's something that was offered by a professor at the NYU Stern School of Business. NYU has been ground zero on this, too. There was a few hundred more people out yesterday. They want their liberated zone back on campus. Where does this come from? Professor Scott Galloway, NYU Stern School of Business, on the double standard.
But I can tell you, if I went into the NYU Square with a white hood on and said, lynch the blacks or burn the gays, my ID would be shut off by that night. And I would never work in academia again. There would be no need for the words context or nuance. I wouldn't be protected by terms like First Amendment or free speech. I would be out of the world of academia. It seems like we have a double standard when it comes to hate speech as long as it's against Jews.
Right. It's true. And yes, you can express noxious viewpoints, as you just heard, we are Hamas, you Zionist pig. Yeah, it's your right as an American, but it's not your right as an American to attend Columbia.
No.
There's no constitutional guarantee for your matriculation in the Ivy League. So that's a choice that's being made, and it's the double standard that's being highlighted.
And I feel bad for the Jewish students there and also the regular students who aren't pro-Palestinian, who they can't go to school now till the end of the year. They have to do remote learning. And they might not have a graduation.
Oh, well.
They might just send them their
sacrifices will have to be made for the liberation. Sacrifices will have to be made in order for the revolution to come. So why this double standard?
Okay, why?
Well, here's one theory from the aforesaid Professor Galloway.
I think it's complicated. I think, one, young people have a healthy gag reflex on what people our age think. And I think that's healthy. Two, I don't think Israel has draped itself in glory over the last 20 or 30 years. They've shifted from being kind of the David to the Goliath. I also think that incorrectly, students on campus conflate the civil rights movement with what is going on in Palestine and have digressed, unfortunately, because of an orthodoxy promoted by me and my colleagues that there are oppressors and oppressed. And the easiest way to identify oppressors is how white and how rich they are, or fairly or unfairly. Israel is seen as ground zero for whiteness and how wealthy they are. And then what might sound paranoid, but doesn't mean I'm wrong. I think we are being manipulated, specifically youth, through their frame for the world is TikTok. And if you look at TikTok, there are 52 videos that are pro-Hamas or pro-Palestinian for every one served on Israel. I think that we are being manipulated. I think Americans are easier to fool than convinced they've been fooled. But if I were the CCP, I'd be doing exactly the same thing. I think social media is sowing division and polarization in our
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. What do you think about the professor's explanation for the double standard?
Spot on.
It's not exactly spot on.
What do you
think? He's somewhat spot on. First of all, this you know, gag reflex at what older people think. It's too charitable. Yes, you can revolt against the older generations and what they say is received wisdom. Fine. But all pushback against authority is not the same. And what you're seeing here is obviously unhealthy. Not healthy for the individuals or the larger society. So don't give me that nonsense about, oh, it's just kids revolting against authority, you know, trying to push boundaries. Nonsense. Stop it. He's trying to, you know, sort of give them more benefit of the doubt than they're owed. And it dilutes the message. That's number one. Number two, Israel hasn't draped itself in glory over the last 20 years. Oh, because they're a Goliath instead of a David. Are they supposed to be the underdog? Are they supposed to play the role of the underdog to terrorist organizations and Islamo-fascist states in the Middle East? What does that mean? Also nonsense. We're supposed to, you know, maintain this role where we're perceived as the underdog, even as we build up to protect ourselves. And if that means that the balance of power has shifted in our direction, good. Because we're the upholder of civilization, and the enemies that seek our elimination are not. I want Israel to be the favorite, not the underdog. Don't you, Professor? I'm sure he does. So stop using weasel words and providing and making any concessions to these barbarians you see on college campuses and the streets and outside of Pagliacci Schumer's home. Now, when he starts talking about identitarian politics, the oppressor and the oppressed, and the professorate's responsibility in promoting that poison, now we're getting somewhere. Len in Highland Park, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning. I think every kid that is on a visa should be deported, and Amy loves the Breakfast Club. For the Americans that are protesting, they should be forced to sit in a situation like in the Breakfast Club with, I can't remember the name of the teacher, but all forced to read the Quran for every Saturday for the rest of the semester, because that's where it's all at. And especially about the part about lying in wait. And it just drives me nuts that there's no major news network that mentions the Quran. I don't know if they're too afraid to say it, that word. But it's all in there. It's diabolical. And you're not fighting one country, one terrorist group. You're fighting a religious philosophy. And that's what I got this morning.
Well, thanks for the call. I mean, obviously, there are peaceful, pluralist Muslims. Many of them reside in America, thankfully. So, you know, that's not the issue as much as it is the Islamists, and particularly the Islamist terrorist sympathizers.
Most of the protesters and the people living in the encampments aren't Palestinian, aren't Muslims. They're radicalized students who are Americans who think, you know what, let's do this. It's the cool thing to do right now. I don't know how Hamas and pro-Palestinians won the PR war, but they did.
Well, that's it's a PR war. I don't think that's a phrase that's used. I don't think so. I don't think that captures it. I don't think the professor exactly has it either. I think he's traveling down the road when he gets on the discussion of identitarian politics. As I said, that is the source of the mind rot. But I mean, I want people to think about that. That Columbia student. Columbia. We are Hamas, Zionist pig. I mean, that is a lot of hate that has been ginned up from somewhere. I think that requires a more thinking and discussing about that. That is a kind of, backwater ignorance that you wouldn't maybe expect. I mean, maybe now we've come to expect it, but certainly a generation ago, you wouldn't expect at the Ivy League. Or any college campus. Did you see what was happening at Cal Poly Humboldt?
Yeah.
Did you see that? I mean, they have the, first of all, they're all masked up, because.
I think to hide their identity, but you think because they're brainwashed.
Oh, yeah. They're brainwashed on so many levels. And everything is symbolic, right?
Yeah, they took over a building, and then they tried to advance and then, further in the building. And the police are there to stop them.
Police in riot gear, and they're hitting a police officer with an empty, big Hinckley water bottle,
yeah.
and pushing back. Now they're trying to push to get them out of whatever building they were in, and they're pushing back. I mean, it was violent. I mean, they all could have been arrested for. A battery of a police officer. Of course, none of them will be.
Looked like an insurrection to me.
I mean, so I really internalize what you're seeing. Think about what you're seeing and what you're hearing and where you're hearing it, from whom you're hearing it and seeing it.
But it's all organized. It's all orchestrated. I mean, here they are. They're all scream at the same time. Here they are.
Okay.
And then they're hitting that water bottle and then the table.
Yeah, okay. So what if it's orchestrated or in part orchestrated? Think about it. I mean, there's no question. There's over-the-top support. I mean, these Students for Justice in Palestine chapters have been on college campuses for generations, and they're financed. Money's coming from somewhere, not just activity fees.
Right.
So, I mean, this is treated as like, oh, it's just a thing that we go through, like the 60s and the war protests and the civil rights movement. And this is just a 21st century iteration of it. I don't think so. This is something that is much more disturbing and damaging. And to just sort of give it the eye roll, back of the hand, college campuses, oh, the Ivy League or Berkeley and so on and so forth. We've seen this act before. No, not exactly. I don't think so. We haven't seen it. It's a new act. It's a new act that's a product of a new political culture. I mean, it's on a continuum, yes, over the last 60 years, but this is a more virulent strain than anything we've seen before. Bill and Glen Ellen.
Yeah, I want to know, at what point will Jewish Americans completely divest themselves of the Democrat Party? And it's not just that, because when they donate to these left-wing groups for the environment or whatever, those groups are the ones who are spending money to support the groups supporting these idiots on these college campuses. When are they going to wake up and realize the Democrat Party, since it was founded, has been anti-Jewish? And they've just been hiding it for the last, 100 years or so. And now it's finally bubbling to the surface. Or they think they have enough power where they don't have to hide it anymore.
Thanks for the call, Bill. Well, Dershowitz is divested, finally. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I don't know. It's not going to be in mass. It's going to be an individual decision. It's tough to... What did that professor say? It's easy to fool Americans. It's tough to get them to acknowledge they've been fooled. I think that's pretty accurate. Will and Skokie.
Hey, how you doing? Remember the old Cultural Revolution in China, where the students supposedly rose up? That was actually supported by the Communist Party. They wanted to get rid of the wafflers in the Communist Party. The same thing here. The Biden administration is staffed primarily by Obama third-term people, and they're running the government, not our president. And what happens is you notice that they are not cracking down on this. These guys are acting totally wrong, but yet the administration and the college administration and the police and everything, they're being held back because this is all about power. This is all about using the students as you know, helpful idiots to support the Biden administration's real agenda. And, you know, just look at what happened with the Cultural Revolution in China. It's the same thing. The students are rising up. It just looks like it's a grassroots thing of the intelligentsia, you know, trying to purge, you know, the non-supporters. And that's what this is all about.
Thanks for the call, Will.
This is The Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
All right, treat the mom in your life to a very special Mother's Day brunch at the Trump Hotel in Chicago on Sunday, May 12th. Enjoy a buffet-style feast with live entertainment and complimentary champagne while seated along the city skyline. For a chance to win tickets, and I'm going to do this, I'm going to go to 560theanswer.com. Keyword mother. That's 560theanswer.com. Keyword mother, and good luck.
All right. Before we get to Twitter Files Australia, the latest country to attempt to direct what will and will not be allowed on Elon Musk's Twitter/X platform, I did want to make good on our promise to review what President Trump had to say in response to all that we were just talking about, all of this unrest and ugliness and anti-Semitic bigotry on the campuses of universities across the country. Here's what his plans are if he is once again elected president. Take a listen.
The time has come to reclaim our once great educational institutions from the radical left, and we will do that. Our secret weapon will be the college accreditation system. It's called accreditation for a reason. The accreditors are supposed to ensure that schools are not ripping off students and taxpayers, but they have failed totally. When I return to the White House, I will fire the radical left accreditors that have allowed our colleges to become dominated by Marxist maniacs and lunatics. We will then accept applications for new accreditors who will impose real standards on colleges once again and once and for all. These standards will include defending the American tradition and Western civilization, protecting free speech, eliminating wasteful administrative positions that drive up costs incredibly, removing all Marxist diversity, equity, and inclusion bureaucrats, offering options for accelerated and low-cost degrees, providing meaningful job placement and career services, and implementing college entrance and exit exams to prove that students are actually learning and getting their money's worth. Furthermore, I will direct the Department of Justice to pursue federal civil rights cases against schools that continue to engage in racial discrimination and schools that persist in explicit unlawful discrimination under the guise of equity will not only have their endowments taxed, but through budget reconciliation, I will advance a measure to have them fined up to the entire amount of their endowment. A portion of the seized funds will then be used as restitution for victims of these illegal and unjust policies, policies that hurt our country so badly. Colleges have gotten hundreds of billions of dollars from hardworking taxpayers, and now We are going to get this anti-American insanity out of our institutions once and for all.
That's pretty good. That's pretty good. You have to impose punishment for this illiberalism on campuses. That's exactly right.
Takeover.
And what you do is you go after endowments and accreditation, too. It's a little bit more complicated, I think, than Trump lays out. But, I mean, this is a vision statement, you know, a policy direction. So the accreditation agencies are regional and they're NGOs, but there is DOE, Department of Education, oversight there. And so I think through the administrative state, essentially, if you don't want to eliminate the Department of Education altogether, which is a good idea, that you can at least attempt to impose your will. And obviously, you talk about taxing endowments. That's the composition of Congress is going to matter there. So he's going to need majorities in the House and the Senate and some real leadership to drive that sort of policy, when I'm sure there's going to be a lot of weak-kneed legislators, including Republicans, who don't want their alma mater or the college in their district, you know, harmed financially in any way. But I like the direction that Trump is taking, the angle. And then the other piece of it, too, is essentially what he's saying there with respect to directing the DOJ to pursue illegal discrimination cases as it pertains to admissions or just general administration at some of these universities, particularly on the admissions side. Well, that's essentially saying we're going to enforce. It's one thing for the Supreme Court to hold an opinion that it held in the Harvard admissions case and say this is what the law means, but it needs to be enforced. And my Department of Justice is going to enforce that decision. So good for him.
I want to say one more thing, too, before we move on. They're allowing that encampment to exist for 48 hours more at Columbia University.
Of course they are.
I mean, they arrested about 100 more people yesterday, but they're letting them stay there in their tents.
They're arresting them. They're turning them. They're releasing them without charges.
Right.
They're going right back. They're unsuspending students who were suspended. The point is this. Of course they are. How did we get to this place? This is part of the conversation. This is part of understanding. It's what Shelby Steele has been writing about for 50 years. Deference. The culture of deference to the illiberal, to the barbarian, to put it in no uncertain terms. The cultural Marxist is the cultural barbarian, and these institutions are rotten with them, and there is nothing but deference. There is no moral authority. No one claims to have any moral authority. Everybody's living their truth. Everybody's identity matters. Their behavior doesn't. Defer, defer, defer. We make no distinction between civilization and barbarism. Well, then you're going to get barbarism. Then you're going to get might makes right, or whoever beats the pickle bucket the loudest. All right. Well, I want to get to Elon Musk, too, on this, because this is Western civilization attacking Western civilization. And I know the Australians don't quite have the same tradition as we do in founding documents. Nobody does. Same commitment to individual liberty. But it's still something to hear, really. I mean, this is arguably as bad or worse than the treatment that Brazil is trying to impose on Elon Musk and X, as we talked about last week, through their Supreme Court. You will cater to our demands on what will and will not be allowed on your platform, or we're going to fine you. And according to one state senator in Australia, if they could, we're going to imprison you.
Oh, my God.
Here's the issue. On Twitter, there was an attack. Well, I mean, not an attack, but there was an attack on a Christian bishop during a sermon in Australia by a Muslim Islamist extremist.
Everybody said that went viral.
Right, of course. So the Australian government wanted it taken down.
The attack after everybody saw it? Okay.
Well, regardless, they wanted it taken down, and Elon Musk said no. In fact, they said this. This was the official statement. Tragic event. We do not allow people to praise it or call for further violence, but there's a public conversation happening about the event on X and across Australia, as is often the case when events of major public concern occur. While X respects the right of a country to enforce its laws within its jurisdiction, the e-safety commissioner, and boy, by the way, I mean, does that tell you everything you need to know? Australia has an e-safety commissioner. It's always safety. The safetyists, the Marxists, the Orwellians, the central planners, these are synonymous terms. The e-safety commissioner does not have the authority to dictate what content X users can see globally, but Australia disagrees, right? Not just that you should cater to their demands, the government, but that their standard should be the global standard. We will robustly challenge this unlawful and dangerous approach in court. Global takedown orders go against the very principles of a free and open internet and threaten free speech everywhere. And the threat is multivariate. One, the e-safety commissioner said that if Musk didn't remove the post, they'd fine X $500,000 a day for removing a post that does not violate Twitter's rules. But the Aussies don't like it. Here's what Anthony Albanese, who is the PM, had to say about Musk during a Sky News interview.
I want to ask you about Elon Musk. He's mocked you this morning for choosing censorship and propaganda over free speech and truth. What's your response to that?
Well, this is a bloke who's chosen ego and showing violence over common sense. I think that Australians will shake their head when they think that this billionaire is prepared to go to court fighting for the right to sow division and to show violent videos, which are very distressing. He is in social media, but he has a social responsibility in order to have that social license. And what has occurred here is that the e-safety commissioner has made very sensible suggestions. Other social media companies have complied without complaint. But this bloke thinks he's above the Australian law, that he's above common decency. And I tell you what, I say to Elon Musk, that he is so out of touch with what the Australian public want. This has been a distressing time. And I find this bloke on the other side of the world, from his billionaire's establishments, trying to lecture Australians about free speech. Well, I won't cop it, and Australians won't either.
So what happens if the vision in question here isn't taken down?
Well, of course, there is a court order has been put in place. It's a sensible proposition. No one is above the law. Not Elon Musk, not any Australian citizen. When it comes to operating here in Australia, he has a business that gives him a lot of profit, and I just find it extraordinary that this bloke thinks he's above the law and above common decency. This shouldn't be a matter of the law. It should be a matter of people doing the right thing.
What you just heard there is what fascism in the 21st century sounds like. All dressed up with phrases like common decency and no one is above the law, what the people want, safety. That's the new lexicon of the fascist. There are other iterations of it, too. A senator in Australia named Jackie Lambie She doesn't use the sanitized language as much as the PM. She's not quite as polished. She's a little bit more direct.
So when it comes to the tech billionaire, like I've already said, I think he's a social media knob with no social conscience. He has absolutely no social conscience. Someone like that should be in jail and the key be thrown away. That bloke should not be have a right to be out there on his own ideology platform and creating hatred, you know, showing all this stuff out there to our kids and doing all the rest. I'm very interested to watch what the US is going to do with TikTok and how far that they can do. We're trying to get rid of that platform as well. So I think we're all watching on the United States at the moment to see what they're doing. But seriously, if we can move, and if that means in the next sitting that we can shut him down from doing this.
He was just displaying what happened.
He didn't do anything wrong at all. No.
They're not blaming the man with the weapon that went after the pastor. They're not saying it's his fault. It's Elon Musk's fault. No, it's not.
He didn't display anything.
No.
But this is the point. We don't like that content. We don't want this conversation. This does not comport with the orthodoxy of the beautiful lies that we tell the public and we tell them about them. And so it needs to be expunged. And if we can't expunge the content, we'll expunge the person platforming it. Right. Yeah. That's what you heard from Albanese in particular, the Australian Prime Minister. Just remember how he explained his position with respect to this controversy that they've created. And see how closely it mirrors the rhetoric you hear from the leftists in this country. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
This is the morning show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So I got wind of this call between Alexandra Pelosi and J6 defendant Greg Rubenacher through Julie Kelly's Twitter feed. Julie Kelly will join us momentarily. But this call is really interesting. Alexandra Pelosi, yes, that's Nancy Pelosi's daughter. She's the documentarian in the family.
How's her dad doing?
And his friends? I don't know. Yeah, good question.
The same question I have
For Paul Pelosi that I had for John Wayne Bobbitt. How's the penis? So
I've investigated that, and I'll have an update for you later.
Yeah,
you gave me a challenge, and I took it.
All right, add Paul Pelosi to that list too.
Okay, thanks.
So Alexandra Pelosi is apparently going to do, or she's attempting to do a documentary about January 6th.
Good.
So she wants to talk to those who have been charged and, in Rubenacher's case, convicted and sentenced to 41 months in prison. Listen to the exchange, though. Remember, Alexandra Pelosi, she's not just Nancy Pelosi's daughter. She's also a woman of the left. So it's not like this is a offspring that revolted against the parents' political ideology. No, no. But listen.
Don't call me back. I got so much for me being, you know, having any power or any access or anything. I can't get anybody to call me back. I don't know why this video. I want to see all the video. I want to see every and all video because video doesn't lie. Video tells the truth.
Yeah, I mean, does this make sense to you? Anything make sense to you from what I told you and the government side?
Well, I got to tell you a couple things. One, you got a liberal judge. She is out for blood, that lady. Now, I think I learned in kindergarten that, like, justice is supposed to be fair. A judge is supposed to be, like, the same.
Bipartisan.
And they're not supposed to be political, and they're not supposed to bring politics to it. And even though presidents appoint judges, they're not supposed to be political. And now it's like one judge you get really makes a difference, because the judges, some judges are giving probation and other ones are giving full jail time. So for the same exact offense, like literally the same exact offense. Now, that is wrong, and that is not what people think is justice. Justice was supposed to be blind, remember? But okay, so that's okay. I know I sound amateur by saying that, but like, ooh, it's political. You're surprised? Yes, I'm surprised. There was this one guy in Texas who was told, you can go home and get probation. And then, because, you know, you're just like all those those Black Lives Matter protesters in the summer. Then on Monday, your judge came in and said, no, it's not like that at all. You're going to jail because you're bad. And so it's, you know, the same offense, and different judges are like using the opportunity to like make it political. So I think that's really weird. And I think that people would be surprised to know that. But yours is particularly egregious because it's so long. The sentence is so long that like it doesn't make sense to me. Like and it's not like anybody talks to me and I can get any answers from anybody about anything. Because you think I have all this kind of information, but I got nothing. Nobody's telling me anything. No one's showing me any videos. I do get people to leak me videos, but they're lawyers for people. Like, it's like I haven't called your lawyer and asked him to leak it to me because he's going to say no. But I try to get lawyers to leak me footage. You know how they have that, like, that database that all the footage is in? I have a guy who I told to leak me your footage. And he's like, okay, yeah, I have to put it on a thumb drive, and I have to, like, sneak it to you somehow, you know, like that. But I'm still hoping that he's going to do it. I'm not 100% sure, because he doesn't want to get in trouble, because if he downloads all the footage and he's not your lawyer, they may be like, why were you downloading that footage? Anyway, so I haven't seen any footage. I haven't seen any footage. I'm in the dark on all of this.
Even if only Alexandra Pelosi knew someone that could help fill in some of the blanks for her.
Mom?
I mean...
Mom, are you out there? It's Mother's Day soon.
How about that phone call?
Oh,
wow.
My goodness. Wow.
And it was like watching a baby take its first step. Wait, what? I used to think that judges were supposed to be fair and non-political, but this seems like it's political.
Welcome to the party.
Yeah, I mean, nice. it's just wonderful to see those first steps. Okay. I mean, you know, you got to leave room for people to come over to your side. So if Alexandra Pelosi wants to have an epiphany on this, I'm all for it. Julie Kelly is you can find her writings and really journalism at Declassified with Julie Kelly. And she's also the author of the book January 6th, How Democrats Used the Capitol Protest to Launch a War on Terror Against the Political Right. Maybe, Julie, you should send a signed copy of your book to Alexandra Pelosi. Thank you for joining us. Appreciate it.
I think I will. Maybe I'll send her some of the surveillance video that I have, and she could dig through it and look for interesting things. But I doubt it.
That's yeah, she doesn't have the connects that you have, apparently. I mean, it's remarkable. Well, I can't get my hands on videos. I can't get anybody to call me back. Gosh, that's really strange coming from somebody with the last name Pelosi and with a track record in Democrat politics, basically.
Well, there's something even more nefarious that she was doing. And at the time, as you'll recall, and we talked about this, all of the surveillance video related to January 6th, the tens of thousands of hours of video captured by security cameras, they were all under protective orders. So what she was actually trying to do is get this kid, he was 22 or 23 on January 6th. He doesn't know what the heck's going on. He's got a public defender. He ended up pleading guilty to 10 offenses. Including obstruction of an official proceeding, got 41 months in jail. So what she was really trying to do is get this kid to give her the surveillance video, the evidence in his case that would have broken a protective order and gotten him in even more trouble by this horrific judge he had, Beryl Howell, who was the chief judge of the D.C. District Court at the time. So it's even more nefarious what she was trying to do. And her, you know, good cop, oh, gee, I'm so sorry. You're going to the gulag. My mom is responsible for it. But, you know, here's my crocodile tears. Can you break?
Well, do you have footage of Greg Rubenacker? And do you know what he actually did on January 6th?
So he went inside the Capitol. He didn't break any windows or break in. He went in after that first breach around 2:15, mm-hmm. wandered around. He was in the rotunda. I think he might have lit up a joint or smoked a joint with someone else. You know, not the worst thing that happens in the U.S. Capitol building.
Well, we know what happened in the Senate chamber, yes. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, he acted badly, and then got in, several people got in scrums with police who were in the rotunda gassing protesters at about 3:30. So at any rate, I'm not defending his behavior, but it also shouldn't result in 10 federal criminal charges, pretrial detention, and then 41 months in a federal prison, for which he finally is in a halfway house, and that's how I got that audio from him. He's broke. He's homeless. His father passed away. He has no money. So, he's trying to get back on his feet.
And
what Alexander Pelosi was trying to exploit, quite frankly.
Yeah, right. I mean, you can't take that in light most favorable to Alexander Pelosi, of course. But I mean, but you still, it's great to have that audio because you still hold her to account for her words. And what she said, requires a lot of follow up questions to be asked if you could get anybody to answer them, including her. But with respect to the judge, Beryl Howell, in this case you just mentioned, an Obama appointee. The reason she imposed 41 months is because the death penalty was not available. This is someone who is imposing some of the more draconian sentences in these cases generally, isn't it?
She is. And if I could write an entire book on Beryl Howell and how she really represents the cancer of the rot and the corruption of Washington, D.C.'s legal and judicial system. She is responsible. She was the chief judge dating back to 2014, as you said, an Obama appointee. She was the chief judge that presided over the Mueller probe, allowed all of the grand jury proceedings and the subpoenas, et cetera. But then January 6th came. She actually set out, established an entire separate set of guidance about how her fellow judges could deny bail for January 6th protesters only. So when we talk about political protesters or political prisoners, excuse me, this is accurate because she actually wrote out an entire order that said if they belonged to a so-called militia group, if they assaulted police, if they made advanced travel plans with a group to go to D.C., this is part of the insurrection. They were part of this mob that tried to overthrow democracy, yada, yada. And you can deny their release even if they're not accused of violent behavior, even if they were charged with something like conspiracy or obstruction of an official proceeding. So she is the one, unfortunately, that Greg Rubenacher got, threw the book at him. And, she is continuing to impose harsh prison sentences to this day. She's not chief judge anymore, but she's still a sitting judge against J6ers.
So last week we heard oral arguments with respect to 1512, the section of the statute of interruption of an official proceeding that is the charge in so many of these cases, including Trump's January 6th case, not solely that charge, but included in hundreds of these cases, including President Trump's J6 indictment. And it seemed like the court, particularly Gorsuch, pretty skeptical of the state's position that provision of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act is applicable in these cases. So we have the prospect that hundreds of convictions are more likely than not to be overturned, don't we?
Yes, we do. So this is 1512C2, as you said, part of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, obstruction of an official proceeding. And this is the carve-out of 1512, as you guys know. This is the criminal statute that deals with tampering with witnesses, tampering with evidence. This is a records-destroying part of the statute, i.e. Arthur Anderson and the Enron scandal. But this DOJ has weaponized it to criminalize political dissent. They've charged it against more than 350 defendants, including Greg Rubenacher, which was the justification for the 41 months in prison. This is driving this obstruction statute because it's punishable by up to 20 years in prison. So this is driving these excessive sentences, even for individuals who have no other crime except a few misdemeanors. Mm-hmm. So, yes, to your point, it was gratifying, encouraging to hear the majority of the justices anyway, admonish U.S. Solicitor General Elizabeth Preligar, representing the government, about how DOJ has intentionally misinterpreted that statute and applied it and turned these people into lifelong felons. So we're hoping we get a positive decision on that within the next, 4, 6, 8 weeks. And yes, it will cause chaos. And guess who warned about the chaos, Dan and Amy? Beryl Howell a few months ago said, we have to prepare this court for this summer because if the Supreme Court comes back and reverses in the case of Fisher versus USA, we are going to be inundated with requests to vacate sentences, release people from prison who are in jail right now on that obstruction count, and, of course, who have pending trials and sentences related to that count as well.
Well, right, and hopefully, if and when those convictions are overturned, then they'll turn right around and they'll make that Nassar settlement that the Department of Justice just agreed to, $138 million for 139 victims for the FBI's mishandling of the Nassar molestation cases. We'll make that look like pocket change with all these defendants that have civil action against the Department of Justice.
I really hope so, because I will tell you, watching these line prosecutors and these judges, including Beryl Howell, so you have 17 or 18 D.C. federal judges of all stripes, Trump appointees down to Clinton, Obama, and Reagan appointees, believe it or not, who have given their imprimatur to the DOJ's abuse of this obstruction count. Only one judge, Carl Nichols, a Trump appointee, was the one who dismissed this count, and that's how it eventually got to the Supreme Court. But this will represent such an unprecedented, really, black eye, not just to the DOJ, but to the federal courts in Washington. There has to be some repercussions for this. We cannot allow them to destroy lives of people on an obstruction count that they knew they were abusing, and the courts knew that they were abusing. But they had to support the J6 insurrection narrative. They had to punish these people. And so when that ruling comes down, if it is in favor of justice and the J6 defendants, we really have to demand that something be done. Mass resignations, retirements, and then, yes, hopefully some civil action against the DOJ and prosecutors who have done this.
And you think it'll come down soon, this summer?
Well, Amy, the Supreme Court term ends in June.
Right.
So, yes, as you know. So we're hoping that there will be some sort of decision. It could take a little bit, but maybe 4, 6 weeks before we get some news on that.
Now, the other federal case against Trump, the classified documents case, there were some documents recently released per order of Judge Cannon in that case that shed some light on the collective effort between Jack Smith and the Biden administration when it as it pertains to this case and prosecuting Trump more generally that you tweeted about. Can you illuminate us on those documents that were released?
Right. So this is the classified documents case, as you said, in Southern Florida. This is Donald Trump and two co-defendants accused of taking national security defense information that jeopardizes the security of the country and then moving boxes around and trying to hide these papers from the FBI and federal agents and a grand jury. So Judge Cannon is acting like an actual judge, unlike the ones I just talked about or some that we see on the news recently, making sure to protect the due process rights of Donald Trump and make sure that Jack Smith is not getting away with what he wants to, which is basically conceal the evidence in this case, not just from the defendants, but from the American people. So what was just unredacted this week, and it's on my Twitter X account, Julie_Kelly2, is a motion that was heavily redacted, filed, and evidence filed in January by the defense. This has been a three-month battle between the courts and the defense and, of course, Jack Smith, who wanted to keep most of this information under wraps. Judge Cannon said, no, I think this is something that the American people need to see. And, of course, what he was trying to cover up is early collusion between the Biden White House, the Department of Justice, the National Archives, and other parties to concoct some sort of documents case against Donald Trump as early as May of 2020. 2021, a few months after he left office. So what it debunks and what it exposes is the official story we were told that Donald Trump turned over these records to the National Archives in early 2022 in OG. The archivist had classified papers there, and then he was all worried and alerted DOJ. That's how that began. No. This dated back months that they were trying to create some sort of case. And that's what the motion revealed, the unredacted motion, and a lot of the exhibits and evidence. So that's just another scandal from this dirty Department of Justice and especially Special Counsel Jack Smith.
How very Soviet of them. Julie Kelly, I get all of her writings and reportings at Declassify with Julie Kelly. Also, pick up her book if you haven't. January 6th, How Democrats Used the Capitol Protest to Launch a War on Terror Against the Political Right. Julie, thank you as always.
Thanks, Dana and Amy. Have a great day.
Thanks, you too. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We have some acolytes of the World Economic Forum in the West. They're trying to sort of soft pedal the Klaus Schwab vision for the world, which is the World Economic Forum, yeah. Vanguard, own property. You, the hoi polloi, do not. You don't need property. You need a small little rental unit and a bicycle. Right. And bugs, and you just live out your insignificant little life at their direction.
And don't buy new clothes. Go to Goodwill. Go to, you know, places like that.
Rent Leslie clothes. Ann Scorgi is a columnist for the Toronto Star. She makes the case that as home prices, because of Canada's sort of strange financial system in terms of how they do home buying plans, have increased significantly, such that, according to her, I don't know, I haven't examined the market, but according to her, households need to earn well over $215,000 to buy a very basic property. We're not talking yards, views, or pools. So while it's easy to feel owning a home is a life goal, probably better to forget it altogether. Here are some of the benefits of renting, in case you didn't know.
Okay, let me hear.
Geographic flexibility. You can end your lease, pack up, and plant roots elsewhere.
Not that easy, but okay. All right.
Also, can't you sell your home, pack up, and go elsewhere if you want
thing.
To?
Do the same thing, yeah.
You don't have to get your hands dirty as a renter. Life is less complicated. You won't have to spend time, money, and energy on the leaky roof or fixing a cabinet or worrying about nearby zoning changes and so forth. Mm-hmm. You end up with more free cash flow.
No, you don't.
Yeah, that's what she says. She did the math. She gave a math an example of a $550,000 condo, buying it versus renting, and I won't go through the math, but it's a very stylized version of that reality. And you also have less debt as a renter because, you know, some people will take out a home equity loan. Well, as a renter, you can't do that, so you won't accrue as much debt. Less financial flexibility is better than more, apparently. Anyway, I just thought it's interesting, this sort of, as I said, soft-pedaling of, you don't need to own private property. That notion is antiquated. It may have worked for your grandparents, but this is the 21st century. Don't own anything, right? Steve Moore is an economist, Govzilla author. Steve, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, guys. By the way, in listening to your little soliloquy there, Dan, I thought I'd let you know that in Santa Monica, California, which is outside
yes.
of Los, you know, in the L.A. area, and, you know, they have a homeless problem there, as Dan, you and Amy know. And so they're going to start putting up I'm not making this up, folks.
Right.
They're going to put the homeless people in $1 million condos.
Right.
What?
I saw that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do they live alone, or are they going to have a buddy, or how's this going to work?
I don't know how it's going to work, but you know what? Santa Monica is a pretty nice place to live. Maybe
Santa Monica's beautiful.
Well, I mean, but
I just think I should sell my house and get a tent.
Well, that's what, but exactly. That's another example of why it pays not to own property.
There you go.
Santa Monica taxpayers will take care of it for you.
But look, here's the problem. When I was listening to you talk about this, home ownership is declining significantly, and that's in part because the mortgage rate now is over 7%. In some areas, it's 7.5 to 8%, and it was about 3% when Trump was president. So now your mortgage payments on a 30-year mortgage, instead of being say $2,000 a month, are $4,000 a month, and so people in their late 20s and 30s. When they should start thinking about buying a home, can't afford it. And so now Biden's saying, well, okay, you don't need to own a home anyway. And by the way, ownership is, if you want to get rich in this country, I mean, you've got to own things. Mm-hmm. You've got to start owning things at an early age, and they'll appreciate in value. When you pay rent, you're just throwing money down the drain. You know, if you're paying a mortgage payment, you're accruing ownership in the property. I mean, that seems obvious, right?
Well, and then also come tax time, you can get, a return.
Yes, you get the mortgage redemption.
You get
tax benefits from this. And I tell my kids, I've got a 31 and 32-year-old son, and they're thinking about buying. And I'm like, yeah, buy a place. Now, I understand, though, the high mortgage rates and the high prices are making it really difficult for people. And, most people, young people, can't afford the American dream. They can't buy a home.
Well, if you buy a home, you have to pay for it in cash. I mean, just like, they did when Carter was president, mortgage rates were 18.9%.
Yeah, I remember that.
I mean, it was ridiculous. I remember my family arguing about it, and they're like, just pay for cash. Just put cash down. Don't take out a loan.
Not everybody is from a billionaire family that you can just pay cash for everything,
well,
Amy.
I mean, the house was $72,000.
Yeah.
In Mount Prospect.
She had to throw that kind of money to just throw around willy-nilly. It's not like you're the city of Santa Monica. By the way, the $1.2 million, $1.2 for those condo units in Santa Monica.
Are you going to start kidding me, huh?
That pales in comparison to the $1.7 million public bathrooms they're standing up in San Francisco. Did you see that, too?
Well, I mean, they've got plenty of money in California. In California, just a little warning to my friends there in the Chicagoland area and in Illinois. Larry Ellison, the chairman and founder of
Oracle.
Oracle, yeah. They're moving out. They were so an iconic Silicon Valley tech company. Mm-hmm. They're packing their bags and they're moving to Nashville, Tennessee, where there is no income tax, folks. No income tax.
He bought an island in Hawaii, and he doesn't want to move there either. That's also interesting. It's funny how people do the math, even people in the billionaire class. Very funny how that works. Hey, I wanted to find out, I think we all do.
Well, by the way, Dan, you don't become a billionaire by throwing your money around anyway. Billionaires are pretty smart with money. And hey, wait a minute. I could stay in California and pay a 14% income tax, or I could move to Nashville, Tennessee and pay zero. Let me think about that for a minute.
Yeah, right. Earth Day, we want to know what you did with Earth Day. You probably were spilling oil on waterfowl or something like that, being the.
Well, we had a little report on Earth Day in our hotline the other day, and this will surprise anyone with a college degree, but it is true that the air that we breathe today is cleaner than any time probably in the last 100 years. And most people are shocked about that because, wait a minute, how can that be true? I mean, we're the biggest polluter in the world. No, all we've been doing for the last 50 or 60 years is cleaning up our air. So if you look at the pollutions that actually, are dangerous to your health, things like lead in the air, sulfur, carbon monoxide, other particulates, we've reduced the concentration of pollutions by, in most major cities, by 70, 80, and some cases 90%. So why do they keep saying we're polluting the planet? Now, what they say, what about carbon dioxide? That's increasing. Carbon emissions. Carbon
Dan, I know I'm going to make a lot of your listeners angry. I'm going to say this. Carbon dioxide is not a pollution. Nobody gets sick from breathing carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is necessary for life on the planet.
Yeah.
So, but the kinds of pollutions that actually, you know, like you have asthma or respiratory problems. And by the way, even, you know, I grew up in Chicago in the 60s. There's no question the air is much cleaner in the Chicago area today than it was 30, 40, 50 years ago. But most kids don't know that.
Well, yeah, that's, although it is more, the air is more bullet ridden than it was back in your day.
I guess that's a form of pollution, right?
I'd say.
Noise pollution, too. Yeah.
So speaking of colleges, your buddy, the former president, Donald Trump, I was channeling Steve Moore a bit in a post that yesterday on colleges, given all of the ugliness that's happening on college campuses, the two words, accreditation and endowments, and he's going to go after both if he's reelected,
Good.
He says.
I had not seen that, but I think that the endowment, look, why are we as taxpayers paying, what is the, I think the price tag now is $150 billion that we're paying to, quote, forgive student loan debt. And I think it's a terrible idea, but if we're going to, if there's going to be student loan forgiveness, it should be paid for by taxing the endowments of these massive, you know, I mean, God, Harvard isn't a university. It's a mutual fund.
Right.
they have like, what is, how big is it now? I can't even keep track of how big their endowment is, like $50, $100 billion. They're a money management firm, and they want taxpayers to pay for the, you know, for the kids that aren't paying back their student loans because they charge $100,000 a year. By the way, can we basically say no more student loans to Columbia?
Well, yeah, but don't limit it to just Columbia. I mean, you know, let's use that as a jumping off point, right?
Well, I mean, what's going on that campus today is so outrageous. And, you know, you've got all these, like, entitled 20-year-olds who've never worked a day in their life who stand in protest against hate America, burning the American flag, you know, while they want American taxpayers to pay for their education.
Hey, that's a daughter of a congressman you're talking about. Knock it off. So one other topic I wanted to get.
Probably a future Congress lady.
Probably. Right? Probably. One other topic I wanted to get to. This also sort of coming from California. But, you know, the bad ideas in California have a way of migrating to places like Illinois. Same thing with New York, I've noticed. Anyway, the CLEAR system that people can use to, you know, frequent flyers can use to get around long lines, long security lines.
Do you have CLEAR?
I do not. I have TSA pre-check.
I don't have either, which is why I support what California is doing, because I'm sick of waiting in lines that you guys don't have to wait in.
Get TSA. What do you got?
And I'm oppressed.
What do you have to hide?
Ooh. Yeah, lots of stuff.
Yeah,
you don't want to get fingerprinted, do you?
I know the story, but what they want to do is CLEAR is you pay, I think, like $75, I forget how much, $100 a year. If you're a frequent flyer like I am, I'm on the road about, you know, at least one day a week, oftentimes, you know, three or four flights a week. You pay for this pre-screening thing, and then you don't have to go through the long lines because you've already pre-screened. They've already gone through the procedure, and you can get through the airport faster. And so the left says, "No, that's unfair. That is unfair to poor
totally.
People. Everybody should have to stand in line for, you know, 45 minutes waiting to get through the security system." And it's almost like, you know, traffic jams. Some of my liberal friends like people sitting in traffic, like a lot of your listeners are right now, because they feel like that's a democratic system. You know, rich people and poor people have to suffer equally. That's what they like, right? That's
right, exactly. We should be miserable together. I mean, that's how you build community around misery.
So they want to eliminate CLEAR?
And by the way, CLEAR, I just want to make sure people understand. The fact that we have a system of CLEAR where people pre-check, that actually reduces the length of lines for everyone. But they don't care if the one person has to wait 5 minutes more than the other person, even if it's a lower wait, they want to get rid of that. And that's democracy for you.
Well, I got news for you. I'm going to help them come after first class next, eliminating first class. So you're going to have to be back in steerage with the rest of us.
What do you have
by
against
the way, Amy,
class?
I know we're running out of time, but I want to tell you, I paid $7 for an ice cream cone. Single scoop.
I know.
Single scoop, $7.
How much was the cone that you bought for Biden? Usually a little ice cream date.
Where did you get this?
Amy and I have been talking about this for months. Inflation is a lot higher than 4 or 5%. It's probably
20%. I'm going 30. I was in the grocery store again, and I can't stomach it. I mean, I'm just buying for two people, and I can't get out of there under $230.
All right, we'll do a.
I need a sponsor. No, yeah, those days are gone when we had the EBT card during COVID, where they gave me what? How much did they give me a month, you guys? Like $900 a month for both kids during COVID. That's how much.
Yeah,
they gave, meaning we. The government.
All right, we'll set up a GoFundMe for Steve Moore's ice cream. We'll let you know how that goes, Steve. Steve Moore, economist, Govzilla author. Thanks, Steve. Appreciate it.
Okay, guys, have a great week. Take care.
I don't know where he's going to get his ice cream, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So yesterday, the Senate passed a $95 billion foreign aid package, with the majority going to Ukraine and some to Israel, some to the Indo-Pacific. And this was Pagliacci Schumer on the Senate floor thanking Speaker Johnson for his leadership. Talk about being damned with faint praise.
I thank Leader McConnell, as I've mentioned before, working hand in hand with us, not letting partisanship get in the way. I thank Speaker Johnson, who rose to the occasion, in his own words, said he had to do the right thing despite the enormous political pressure on him. And I thank Leader Jeffries, who worked so well together in his bipartisan way with Speaker Johnson. And let me say this once again about my friend, the Republican leader. We were of one mind to get this bill done. It was our bipartisanship, our linking of arms together, that got this large and difficult bill through the Congress, despite many political ideologues who wanted to bring it down. Bipartisanship once again prevailed, and I thank him for his leadership.
Absolutely. If there's one thing Chuck Schumer isn't, he is not ideological.
No, not at all.
No. And one of the other things that we know, too, is that anything that is done in a bipartisan fashion is an unalloyed good. It is impossible to do damage if it's bipartisan. Any legislation, any spending, if you get Republicans and Democrats, the leadership, the Republican and Democrat Party together to do something together, it is always good. We've seen that in Illinois. Republicans and Democrats, when they come together to do something, it is always for your benefit.
Yeah, it's for the people.
Mm-hmm. Right. Uh-huh. Meanwhile, while they were speechifying over the Senate, there's a House delegation that rushed off to Ukraine to visit with Zelensky to report back. They still haven't stopped waving those little flags. And one of the most excited members of the House Socialist Caucus was this Massachusetts dude, congresswoman, named Bill Keating. Oh, man. He scurried over to Zelensky to show him the vote totals. Look how good we did.
We did it.
Senator Bill Keating from Massachusetts. And I have something that you're really going to like.
Yeah.
This is the official tally of the vote.
Yes, I see.
For the supplemental aid.
Get out of my face.
Yes.
And look at that vote. 73%.
Yes. Thank you so much. 73.
That's a good vote.
Good.
That's a good vote. We did good. We did good.
Wow, butt kicker. Ooh. I mean, kisser, excuse me.
And you know, this is separate and distinct from the conversation about Ukraine funding and support in trying to repel Putin. But this whole theatrical performance is stomach-turning, for me, at least. And, oh, by the way, of course, they can't help but spike the football. It's not – their bipartisanship goes only so far. I mean, it doesn't include people like the former president or Tucker Carlson, both of whom McConnell blamed for making the process more laborious than it needed to be.
I think the demonization of Ukraine began by Tucker Carlson, who, in my opinion, ended up where he should have been all along, which is interviewing Vladimir Putin. And so he had an enormous audience, which convinced a lot of rank-and-file Republicans that maybe this was a mistake. I think the former president had sort of mixed views on it. We all felt that border was a complete disaster, myself included. And Chad, you remember covering the phases we went through. First, there was an effort to make law, which requires you to deal with Democrats. And then a number of our members thought it wasn't good enough. And then our nominee for president didn't seem to want us to do anything at all. That took months to work our way through it. So we ended up doing the supplemental that was originally proposed, which dealt with not all problems. It didn't solve the border problem, but certainly addressed the growing threats at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Trump, you know, being characterized as don't do anything because, you know, I'm cynically want this to be a political issue rather than don't do what you're proposing to do with Lankford carrying the water, because this is about leveraging the power of the purse to get Biden to make policy changes that the executive can be made and therefore focus the responsibility where it belongs. And, oh, by the way, it was Speaker Mike Johnson who said there's not going to be foreign aid funding without addressing the border. And he rejected what McConnell and Lankford had cooked up with Democrats in the Senate. It's a little bit more complicated than Senator Freeze frame there is suggesting. For more on this, please be joined by Jed Babin, former United States Deputy Undersecretary of Defense. He's a contributor to The Washington Times and The American Spectator as well. Jed, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
So what's your distillation of this $95 billion package and the speechifying from McConnell in particular?
Well, anything bipartisan is certainly totally controlled by Chuck Schumer in the White House. Mm-hmm. We've known that for a long, long time. So being bipartisan is kind of a definition of being bad. But in this case, we had to do something for Ukraine. We have to have an interest in stopping Vladimir Putin's progress, and we have an interest, not a vital national security interest, but a definite national security interest in blocking Putin from getting any farther into Ukraine. So, you know, Ukraine is probably not going to win this war. We've waited too long and spent too much time debating about what aid we should be giving them to really have any good come out of it. The Europeans are trying to claim that they're sending 90%+ of the aid to Ukraine. Nonsense. You know, the Germany sent a few tanks and they didn't work, so Ukraine sent them back. I mean, that's the kind of thing that Europe is doing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, at this point, going forward with aid to Ukraine is a good thing for our national security interests. Nobody seems to recognize that, and certainly not Marjorie Taylor Greene or Bob Good or Matt Gaetz or any of those idiots.
But what are they doing with our money? I mean, last time, I think $70 billion was used to help promote or support their small businesses. So what is it for this time?
Well, supposedly it's for direct military aid, and supposedly it's partially repayable. Of course, $10 billion of that is, partially a loan. It's never going to be repaid. I think we have a situation clearly where Ukraine is corrupt. There is siphoning off of our aid, and it's going to corrupt purposes, but still we have to try. You know, we can't not do it and let Ukraine just fall and let Poland and Moldova and the rest of the Eastern Europeans fall back under Russian control.
Well, okay, so there's a couple of things there. But first, I want to get your distinction. You said it's in our national interest. It's not a vital national interest, but it's a national interest. What's the distinction?
Well, a vital national security interest, and this was taught to me by a really smart guy, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Dick Myers. We have national security interests, and we have vital national security interests. A vital national security interest is something that protects our direct freedoms under the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, freedom of speech, and so forth. When those things are threatened, we go to war. If we have the freedoms of space, cyber, seas, and our own airspace threatened, that's when we go to war. Other than that, there is no reason for America to intervene into a war. There is a reason for us to help others and other countries, but we don't have a reason to go to war ourselves. We're not neocons. Conservatives are not neocons. Mm-hmm. We do not want to intervene in just any old war that comes up. We do not want to have insecure borders. We do not want to have our foreign policy subsumed to the United Nations. We do not want to do any of those things. It's like Henry Nouwen wrote in his great book, Conservative Internationalism. That's what we really are. We're conservative internationalists. We do not hesitate to interfere in the affairs of other nations when it's in our interests, but we do not go to war unless we have a vital national security interest.
When McConnell said the in his speech on the Senate floor that aid now, it's sort of an ounce of prevention sort of speech, and aid now lessens the chance that we'd have to put American troops on the ground in Eastern Europe. But I mean, are the two really connected? That if this $60 billion to Ukraine wasn't in route, that we necessarily are looking at the prospect of American troops on the ground there?
Not necessarily, but we have to look at the fact that, you know, Ukraine borders NATO nations, Poland, for example. Mm-hmm. I mean, if Poland is attacked, we go to war. That's in the NATO treaty. That's the mutual defense obligation. If one is attacked, all go to war. So I guess, you know, really it's not true what Mr. McConnell was saying. You know, he's saying we're not going to go to war over Ukraine. He's not saying that. I'm saying that. The fact of the matter is we go to war where our treaty obligations call us out, and that's the basic truth of it. If we go to war over Ukraine, we'd be making a huge mistake.
And what is the – I mean, you said it in terms of Poland, Moldova, the Baltic states, the argument that's been made about Putin's revanchist ambitions.
Yeah.
But I mean, what is the – you would know better than I. What is the real assessment of the likelihood of that, the capacity that Russia has to move beyond Ukraine and face a prospect of trying to take a NATO – member and knowing what that would implicate?
Well, I don't know that Putin has made a decision yet to conquer Poland or conquer, well, I don't know if Moldova is even a member of NATO at this point, but the point really comes down to, I think we can't totally assess that. What we can do is we can look at Russian and Putin's philosopher, Alexander Dugin. Alexander Dugin wrote in his book, Foundation of Geopolitics, and Putin is a Duginist. He is someone who believes in Dugin and follows what Dugin says. Dugin wrote that unless Ukraine is conquered, Putin may as well never even bother with the rest of the Russian Empire in terms of restoring it over Eastern Europe. So he's going to go after Ukraine till hell won't hold it. And I think that's what we have to recognize. We have to aid Ukraine again, but not send U.S. troops, not get directly involved.
But so what are we, so what's our horizon here? I mean, and this whole, and you know, and there's like, though those are Ukraine decisions. Well, at some point it's got to be a decision that's in consultation if we're the underwriter or a significant underwriter. And so do we give this a few months to see what happens with the $60 billion, and then we're back to make an assessment and potentially more funding? Do we watch this play out over the next year? I mean, what's the approach that's taken once this money is and these the other forms of aid are sent? You know, how do we then process and position with respect to Ukraine?
Well, I think we're going to have to cross that bridge a couple of months down the road. But, and I emphasize this with a capital B, I think Ukraine is in great danger of losing this war. They're not just short of troops, which they are. Mm-hmm. And Russia can continue to feed troops in. You know, the Russian economy is like 10 times the size of Ukraine's. But they can also, Ukraine is not just running out of artillery ammunition. They're running out of artillery barrels. You can only shoot so many thousands of rounds through a 155-millimeter howitzer before the barrel wears out. And, you know, even if they ordered them now, even if we tried to manufacture them now, it'd be 18 months before we could get them delivered. So, you know, this is going to be a very bad time for Ukraine. It's not going to get better. It's going to get worse. And, you know, a couple of months from now, we're going to have to face this question again.
The position of House Republicans, I mean, I read your piece in The Spectator, and I agree with you. I'm not pushing for Mike Johnson to be deposed or anything like that. But to get nothing out of this along the lines of either a change in border policy or a change in energy policy, particularly energy policy. I mean, I don't want to actually prioritize one, but with respect to geopolitics, obviously Biden's energy policy is enriching our enemies like Russia, like Iran, and that doesn't make any sense. To not use the opportunity to make these bigger arguments and to really try to leverage the power of the purse, slim as the majority is, I just thought was a missed opportunity for Johnson.
Well, I totally agree with you. Don't get me wrong. I am not against Republicans trying to do more for our border and trying to do more to stop Biden. What I am for is trying to get them to get their act together. Mm-hmm. You know, the basic point is there's so few votes. There's only like a 2-vote majority right now. And thanks to people like Ken Buck, who resigned early, you know, we have a very thin majority. If the Republicans can't get their act together, what they ought to be doing is they ought to be telling Biden nothing. I mean, nothing passes the House until you do something about the border. Nothing. We will do no work. We will do no jobs. We will not clear any of your appropriations bills. Nothing. Nothing will get done. I don't care if the government stops. I don't care if there's a government shutdown. You know, that's the point. They have to have enough guts to do this. And they don't. They simply don't.
Jeb Babin, former United States Deputy Undersecretary of Defense, contributor to the Washington Times and American Spectator. Jeb, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Hey, my pleasure.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So, as I understand it from Brotherly Love Spice's kid, who's, I think, still suspended from Barnard.
Yeah.
She's getting by. I don't think... We're on a starvation watch, even though she's homeless and she's not allowed to go into the cafeteria at Barnard. She doesn't have her access cards anymore.
Yeah, she's homeless and hungry, Dan.
Yeah. But the good news is, the good news is she's in a community, as she described it on MSNBC, that's welcoming, that's collaborative, that's peaceful. Basically, in this encampment, you know, they sit around and have s'mores. And talk about, what it's like to be oppressed. And then there'll be some time for the death to Israel, death to America chance. But, it's very community oriented.
Yeah.
Although sometimes in order to have a community, they have found, I don't know if they'll use this language, it could be triggering. You have to exclude others, and that includes the university. They excluded a management professor there. We've had him on the show, I believe, Shai Davidai. He's a professor there. He's Jewish, and he didn't like being denied access to campus to stage a peaceful counter-protest to the encampment.
Media in, is the university keeping the media out? This is the COO of the university. Are we not letting the media in?
What?
Can you back up, please? My card has been deactivated? Why?
Can you back up, please?
Uh-huh.
Wait. Everybody, my card has been deactivated. This is Cass Holloway, the COO. This is Gerald Lewis. They were in the meeting where I asked them if Hamas is a terror organization, and they couldn't say that it is a terrorist organization. Why? I'm a professor. Why can't I?
Shai,
we
are willing to take you to the math lawn.
No, I am a professor here.
We are columnists. We have a right.
Whoa, everybody quiet. I am a professor here. I have every right to be everywhere on campus. You cannot let people that support Hamas on campus and me, a professor, not go on campus. Let me in now.
Well, no. And of course, they did it. Guess why?
For his own safety.
Of course.
Because if it saves one life.
You got to protect everybody, keeping everybody safe. But I don't understand. Why would there be any fear for the professor's safety when this is a peaceful, loving, communal encampment? Strange.
Makes me sick that him and others have been locked out. And then they're locked out of in-person learning, might not have a graduation. And here's another, her name is Hagar, and she's in the International Jewish Studies program at Columbia.
It shouldn't be that we have to shut down classes and go virtual and force us to stay home and encourage Jewish students to stay home because the protesters have created an unsafe environment. It should be the other way around.
I don't understand. On the one hand, this is for your safety, and the other, it's totally peaceful. So which is it? Maybe some of the other instances that have been captured suggest why it's not exactly completely peaceful. Like this exchange between a kafifed undergrad and a Jewish student. These Jewish students were entering a building, and the one guy you'll hear was draped in an Israeli flag. So, again, sort of a counter-protest, which is perfectly within the lines. But you'll have to decide if the response to the from the pro-Hamas protester was within the lines.
Keep it moving, you silent bitch. Keep it moving.
You're what? You're Hamas?
Yes, we're all Hamas,
hey? Long live Hamas!
Fuck you!
So unhinged.
We are all Hamas, you Zionist pig. So you're undergrads, I presume, at an Ivy League school, so you understand the implication of saying you're a member of a terrorist organization. So that's not exactly a thinly veiled threat, that is. And, you know, the clip we played yesterday perhaps is the most troubling, even more troubling than that hysterical ignoramus that you just heard.
What could be worse?
This is the cult-like atmosphere, and this is the repeat after me leadership in the encampment, a very autonomous zone, liberation zone oriented. The repeat after me when the encampment was threatened by a Jewish person or two.
Attention, everyone. Everyone to form a human chain right here, please. We have Zionists that have entered
the camp.
My check! My check! Repeat after me.
We have me.
We have Zionists.
We have Zionists.
Who have entered the camp.
Who have entered the camp.
We are going to create a human chain.
We are going to create a human chain.
Where I am standing.
Where I am standing.
So that.
So that.
And infringe upon our privacy.
And infringe upon our privacy.
And try to disrupt our community.
And try to disrupt our community.
Please join me in this chain.
Please join me in this chain.
Do you see how hostile this is? And you're asking me not to record?
Hostile.
walk and take a step forward.
Yeah, I absolutely feel right.
Take a step forward.
So that we can.
So that we can.
Start to push them.
Start to push them.
Out of the camp.
Out of the camp.
One step forward.
One step forward.
Another step forward.
Another step forward.
Do you feel threatened? Oh, you mean by this Children of the Corn routine in front of me? Yeah, I feel threatened.
A little bit, yeah. A little creepy.
Ben Appel is a Columbia University graduate. He's written for Newsweek, Free Press, Unheard, and the Washington Examiner. His Substack is substack.com/@BenAppel, A-P-P-E-L. Ben, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So, how are things? I know you're an alumnus at this point, but how are things on campus now? They keep extending the deadlines for the encampment to disband, don't they?
Yeah, I spent the last couple of days up there just to kind of see what was going on. I felt like I had to see it for myself. And late last night, the president had issued a deadline of midnight for the encampments to clear, and it didn't happen. She extended it to, at first it was 8 a.m. As far as reports were saying. And then I think now she has given them an additional 48 hours with additional, you know, constraints, perhaps additional guidelines and so on. I think that the students wanted proof, perhaps in writing. This is according to Columbia Spectator, that there weren't going to be police or National Guard sent in. I'm not really sure what all the negotiations are, but the students, protesters have a really high list of demands.
Of course.
They want to, the university to meet before they leave.
Why wouldn't they? The university is properly deferential. I mean, you're not that far removed from being an undergrad at Columbia. So Does what is happening now surprise you?
No, not at all, really. It doesn't surprise me at all. I mean, that's the thing. It's like, you know, I graduated in 2020, May 2020. So 4 years ago, I wouldn't have thought, I wouldn't have been able to predict that in 4 years there's going to be an encampment of tents, you know, on the South Lawn. But when I visit the school, none of it surprises me in terms of, like, how, I guess, radicalized a lot of these students have become, and just the general hostility towards Israel specifically and the university's relationship with it. There's just, it's a really strong undercurrent that I noticed from my first week, or even before I began, even during orientation week, back in late 2016.
Well, what did you see back then? What were you hearing?
Well, it was, so I was always a liberal Democrat. I always, you know, and I kind of understood it as part of the Democratic platform that, you know, we support Israel. And when I got onto campus and overheard other students talking, they were saying things like, oh, well, you know, everybody knows that the progressive position is to be pro-Palestine and anti-Israel. And I realized, oh, wow, I have a lot of catching up to do. And then I started taking classes with, you know, professors who were, you know, virulently anti-Israel. And so just kind of picking this up as I went along, that's what I noticed.
NYU business professor suggested sort of this double standard of free speech and tolerance except for Jewish students. I think there's other exceptions, but this is the one that we're focused on right now, has to do with the oppressor oppressed indoctrination orthodoxy that is present on campuses, including throughout the Ivy League, clearly, as well as TikTok and social media, but TikTok specifically, where he argued that pro-Palestinian videos, tributes, you know, outnumber pro-Israel videos and tributes by like 58-1. Do you agree, like, it, or do you have other perspective on this radicalization that you witnessed in terms of how it came to be?
So it really is. I mean, it's a complex thing, and it affects everybody differently. I mean, there are a lot of students that are still attempting to protest peacefully. A lot of But then, of course, there are nefarious actors within there, and then just outside the campus, just outside the gates. And this is like, you know, yards and yards away from the encampment, because the Morningside campus isn't very big, are protesters that are, you know, some that might be affiliated with the university, but a lot that are not, that have shown up, mm-hmm. that are really radical and that are chanting, you know, pro-Hamas and burn Tel Aviv to the ground and things like that. So it's a complex thing, but the thing is that the ideology is you're right, it's actually pretty simple. It does come, everything is kind of filtered through this prism of oppressed versus oppressor, and there's this, you know, there's this hierarchy, and whoever is lowest is correct or right or morally pure or good, and that's a really simple kind of reductive take, but it's really pretty accurate in terms of how it gets into these young folks' heads and primes them to just see everything through that lens.
But, you know, it's one thing to see things through that lens, be convinced that this is the right and proper way to conceive the world. It's another thing to be completely unhinged and hysterical and borderline frothing at the mouth. That's not sort of a dispassionate philosophical framework. That is clearly engendered by real hatred. I wonder what your perspective on that is, you know, where that vitriol comes from.
Vitriol. Yeah. I mean, it is, oh gosh. I mean, it's, I guess maybe there's a contagious, you know, contagion, there's a contagious element to it. There's a lot of, you know, there's not really a lot of teaching about the values of empowerment and survival and lifting oneself up. It's very much about victimhood and how you're oppressed and accentuating that, and then kind of channeling that into a resentment and an anger. And I think mm-hmm. that's where a lot of that comes from. So I think that's really attractive for a lot of young people, especially who are just uncomfortable and confused and don't know where they are in the world and what's happening, and they want meaning and they want you know, connection and purpose. And so this is the outlet that it takes them. And it could be really positive, but this is a really negative way to channel it. But, you know, this is just a really continuation of what began in the late 60s at Columbia. I mean, we all grew up on this, you know, from these generations. My generation, I'm a millennial, I'm 41 now. It's just romantic, kind of romanticized view of the late 1960s and all of these radicals that came and protested and started these huge riots at the school. And then, you know, against the Vietnam War. And so there's this such a strong desire from these young impressionable people to like recapture that and to be able to relive that and replicate that. And that's what I see so much of what is going on currently.
This is so different. I mean, I look at this encampment and there's the trans flag, the gay flag, and these really nice tents. Those are expensive tents. Do you have any idea or any rumblings of, I mean, no, seriously, because I camp and those, there's got to be $200-$300 a pop, mm-hmm. and there's dozens of them. So
right.
who's funding all this?
That's a really good question. There have been speculations about that because, you know, a lot of the tents are the same. Who knows? I mean, that there's a lot of speculation about where a lot of the money comes from with these coalition groups, these student organizations. You know, I don't know all of the details about the funding, but there have been people that have speculated, and perhaps people have proof, I have no idea, that a lot of the funding comes from pretty nefarious people and actors and organizations. But yeah, there are. But I mean, you know, again, you brought up a good point. These are really, you know, many of these students come from ridiculously wealthy families. And like I wrote in my, you know, short piece for the Spectator, it's like, you know, why are they masked? Revolutionaries are typically proud. They kind of want themselves captured on camera and to get. But I think that a lot of these young folks are terrified. They still want to be able to have job prospects after they graduate. They're not sure which way the pendulum is going to swing. Their parents probably are also texting them and calling them and saying, if I catch you on video, if I catch you on, you know.
Wear a COVID mask so we can't
see you. Thousands and thousands of dollars on their education. So there's a lot at stake here. And I mean, these students are paying a lot of money to go here. They could have chosen not to go here, but they did choose to go to Columbia and work their butts off. It's like a 4% acceptance rate. So,
if you had to do it over again, would you go to Columbia, or alternatively, maybe you have a child, I don't know, but would you send your child there?
I never would send a kid, my kid there. I would never send. I don't have kids, but I have friends with kids and, you know, mm-hmm. family, and I would never do that. I did appreciate my experience there because of what I learned about this culture. So, mm-hmm. and I did get a good education there. It's a research institution, so I did learn a lot. For me, I was a non-traditional student, so I had dropped out years ago and then went back to school, and they have a program there for continuing students where, you know, non-traditional students can just be matriculated in with everybody. So I was in my 30s when I went, so I had a little bit more of a filter. I was grown up. I had had real life experience, so I was able to kind of sift all of this insanity through a filter of, oh, wow, that doesn't actually seem right. And then the longer that I was there, the more I realized that, oh, okay, I'm really lucky that I have critical thinking factor, you know, faculty, and that I can look at this from a more experienced perspective.
Ben Appel, Columbia University graduate. He's written for Newsweek, Free Press, Unheard, Washington Examiner. Get his musings at his Substack, substack.com/Ben Appel. Ben, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.